I apologize for speaking here in English, but if I spoke in Spanish, I would have much more to apologize for. Because the closest I can come to speaking Spanish is speaking Italian, and my Italian is very bad. This talk ultimately is based on a seminar I have taught a number of times at a law school in California where I teach. And the seminar consists of examining technological revolutions that might happen in the next few decades. In my view, predicting the future is hard, and I think predicting it 100 years out is harder, so I try to limit myself to the reasonably near future. And one of the conclusions I reached from teaching this seminar is that everybody is much too conservative. That is to say that virtually everybody's background assumption is that the world is not going to change. And that's very unlikely. That the range of possible futures, both good and bad, is much, much wider than people assume. And one of the things that struck me about this, some years ago, the graduation speaker at my university was the U.S. Secretary of Transportation, Norman Mineta. And I heard him talking to some students after his speech. And he was talking about the problem of running out of gasoline. And he said someday, perhaps 100 years from now, someone will put the key in the ignition of his car and turn it. And the car won't start because there's no more gasoline in the world. And what struck me about that was not his striking ignorance of the relevant economics, because he was really making a point that obviously if we were really running out of gasoline, it would be obvious for a long time, the price would go up, and people would be gradually adjusting. What struck me was the extraordinary conservatism of his vision of the future. The idea that 100 years from now, the way you go from one place to another starts by putting a key in the ignition and turning it. It isn't even true now. One of the recent cars I rented didn't have a key. It had a little gadget, which you had in your pocket, and when you sat behind the wheel, the car recognized you were there, and you turned something, and the car started. And that's 5 years after Mineta gave his talk, maybe not as much as 10. Not 100 years after. I do not know how 100 years from now you will get from here to there. Quite possibly you will do it in cyberspace via virtual reality. You will stay physically exactly where you are, but the other person will appear to you and you will appear to him. Possibly you will do it by taking a space elevator because the place you're going is a space habitat at L5, at the Lagrangian point where you have stable orbits around the Earth, basically. I don't know, but it's not likely to be the same way. This talk will necessarily cover a very small part of the contents of a seminar that lasts for a semester. About 4 months, a little more than that. However, if you are curious, I turned the seminar into a book. The book is called Future Imperfect, and the book can be read for free on my webpage because I have webbed it. So if you want to go to my webpage and hear the rest of the lecture, which will be many hours long, you can read it on the webpage. My webpage is daviddfriedman.com. That's one word. D is my middle initial. If I had applied 3 or 4 months earlier, I could have gotten davidfriedman.com, but someone beat me to it. So I'll be talking about two different things. One of them is technologies that might revolutionize our lives in any of many different ways. And one of them is about how such revolutions affect us and how to adjust to them. New technologies change what you can do and what it costs to do it. Not only what I can do, but what other people can do, which is why I'm not always in favor of them, because sometimes the other people want to do things that I'd rather they not do. And let me give one example. A while ago, there was a bill in the U.S. Congress, which I think eventually passed, which was being pushed by law enforcement, by the FBI, to require phone companies to do things to let them tap phone calls made over digital lines. And the FBI claimed, for all I know truly, that digital lines were making the methods they now used to legally tap phones unworkable. Some of the people who were criticizing this bill pointed out that the capacity they were asking for, that they were asking the phone companies to supply, amounted to the ability to tap roughly a million phones at a time, which seemed a little excessive. And this reminded me of a movie. I don't watch very many movies, but it was one of the few I have watched and enjoyed. I don't know if any of you have seen it, but it's called The President's Analyst. And it's a movie in which it finally turns out that the evil people behind all the other evil people are the phone company. And furthermore, the phone company no longer has any humans in it. It's entirely computerized. But there's one very funny scene. The protagonist is the president's psychoanalyst, and people are trying to get control of him to influence the president. And he, at one point, goes into a phone booth. Various bad guys have been chasing him. And he calls up a CIA agent who is on his side. And he then tries to open the door of the phone booth, and he can't. And a phone company truck comes down the road with a crane on it, picks up the phone booth with the protagonist inside, puts it on the truck, picks up an empty phone booth and replaces it, and drives off. And a minute later, because this is a movie, the helicopter with the CIA agent and his buddy, who happens to be a Russian agent, land. And they look in astonishment at this empty phone booth. And the American says, "It can't be. Every phone in America tapped? Don't be absurd. Where do you think you are, Russia?" The reason it reminded me of it is that it is in fact now possible to tap every phone in America. It turns out if you look at law enforcement wiretapping, the real limit to that historically is not the problem of getting a court to let you do it. It's the fact that wiretapping is very expensive. Because in order to do wiretapping, you have to have a human being listen to hundreds or thousands of hours of conversation in the hope of finding what you're looking for. This problem is now solved. Computers work fast and cheap. And computers can turn speech into words. There are computer programs that do it in order that you don't have to type. And computers can search through words for key phrases. And I did a rough calculation. It was a long time ago. I don't remember the exact numbers. But it looked to me as though it would only take perhaps $10 or $20 million worth of dedicated hardware to listen to every phone call in America. So that's one example where what seems like, in many ways, is a desirable technological change, the fact that we have computers, that they can do speech to text, also have some potentially undesirable consequences. There are lots of other such cases. I'll discuss other ones. And there are lots of desirable consequences. The book is called Future Imperfect, because I'm not arguing that the future is either good or bad. I'm arguing it's good in some ways and bad in others. When computers change what can be done, the obvious response is to try to keep doing whatever you're doing. So that the obvious response when you realize that the FBI has the technical ability to tap all of the phones is to try to make laws against it, to try to stop them from doing it. Similarly, I'll be discussing in a little while the problems of enforcing copyright law. And the obvious response, if you believe in copyright laws, many people do, I'm sort of neutral on that particular argument, is to say, well, however hard it is, you just keep doing it. And that's, I think, the wrong answer. That everything we do, whether tapping people's phones or enforcing copyright law or talking to people or anything else, we do for a purpose. We do things that are solutions to problems. The FBI wants to tap phones, hopefully to prevent crime. People who want to enforce copyright law want to enforce copyright law so that books will be written and songs will be played. When technology changes, quite often the way you were doing something no longer makes any sense. And therefore, the right approach, in my view, if you don't like the effect of technological change, is to try to figure out what's now the best way of accomplishing whatever you want to accomplish. And sometimes that involves, again, using the new technology. So that, to take the wiretapping example, if you are worried that the FBI will tap all the phones and we will have no secrets, the solution is probably not laws restricting the FBI, but to spread the use of encryption so that when they tap the phone message, what they get is, which isn't very much use to them. And I will go into the same issue. Let me take the case of copyright. And I'm not, people can argue, can discuss later whether there should be copyright. I taught a course that was partly about that last semester, a different course. And I think there are arguments for copyright and arguments against copyright, and it's an interesting topic, but not the one I'm talking about tonight. But the argument for copyright, its purpose, is to reward creators, to make it possible for people who write books to make a living doing that, to give them a reason to write books. In order to enforce copyright law, you have to know when people have copied things in order that you can sue them, in order that you can use the law against them. The easier it is to copy things, the harder it is to do that. Computer files are very easy to copy, and they're very easy to distribute. So the result is what I refer to as the death of copyright. The fact that as more and more of our intellectual property is in the form of computer files, whether music or books or films, the harder and harder it is to enforce copyright. And one could imagine, if somebody has, that's the law, we have to enforce it. You could imagine laws that would enforce it, but they are not laws anybody would like. Because in order to enforce copyright law in the new technology, you would have to let the owners of copyrights search every hard disk in the country to make sure it didn't have an illegitimate copy of their intellectual property. And to do that, you would have to make it illegal to have any storage medium or any computer that wasn't connected to the internet so that the people who had copyright could search it. That is not, I think, in any existing advanced country a believable policy for reasons that should be pretty obvious. But there are alternatives. One alternative is to use not law to protect your intellectual property, but the computer equivalent of locks and keys and barbed wire fences. There are a variety of approaches to what's called technological protection, in which you try to create your intellectual property in ways that can't be copied. Most of them don't work. Most of them don't work because however good the encryption on your song, once I pay to play it once, I can have a tape recorder recording it when I play it once, and it's now outside of your encrypted protection. So the result is that for any kind of intellectual property that is fully revealed when you use it, it is not possible to protect it that way. But there are important forms of intellectual property that are not fully revealed when they are used. For example, an example that all of my students were familiar with is that there are some very large databases of law cases called Lexis and Westlaw, which make lots of money selling lawyers access to them. Well, after I have downloaded a case, it's no use to anybody else because they want to download a different case. So you can use technological protection to make sure that you sell people the answer to their question, but you don't sell them access to the database that contains them. So that's one way in which you might be able to protect some kinds of intellectual property without copyright law. Another important example, important to many people, perhaps some of you, is games like World of Warcraft. All right? If you are watching a movie, you could record that movie and in effect pirate it. If you're playing World of Warcraft, you could record your adventure in World of Warcraft, but your friend doesn't want your adventure. He wants his adventure. So as long as World of Warcraft can protect its servers, it doesn't have to worry about copying. So I have argued that one result of this technology is that forms of entertainment like World of Warcraft are going to have a real advantage over movies. Because movies cannot protect the ownership of the people who create them, and World of Warcraft can. There are other ways of doing it. Another way of supporting yourself while creating intellectual property is to give away the intellectual property and make money indirectly from doing that. I like to say that the web is a tolerable technology for selling information, but a wonderful technology for giving it away. So that, for example, if you're a musician, you can give away your music and sell tickets to your concerts. If you're an author, you can give away a book that makes you the expert on some subject and then charge consulting fees or give speeches. There was an American political figure, author, speaker by the name of William F. Buckley, some of you may have heard of. And he wrote a book collecting many of his speeches. At the beginning of it, he said that the secret that authors don't tell you is that giving speeches pays much better than writing books. As you may know, a number of famous American authors, including Mark Twain, made quite a lot of their income by speaking tours. So in general, you can one solution when you can't protect intellectual property is not to do everything you can to protect it, but to find ways that don't require that, by which you can still make money. And that applies, among other things, to my books. As I said at the beginning, you can read Future Imperfect for free. When I started webbing my books, it probably made me money. Because 10 years ago, the ways of reading things on a computer were clumsy enough. So if you wanted to read the book, you probably bought it. And the wonderful thing about webbing my books is that people can find them who are not looking for them. Because Google is your friend. So someone is looking for a subject, he finds a hit on my book, it turns out it's interesting, he buys the book. That may not work much longer. Because nowadays, everyone has a Kindle. And nowadays, it's getting easier and easier to read computer files as books. I'll keep webbing my books because the real payoff to my putting up my books is spreading my ideas. Getting paid for it is very nice. I don't mind being paid, but it's not the main objective. I like to say that when you are young, you are afraid people will steal your ideas. When you are old, you're afraid people won't steal your ideas. And webbing my books is a way of making it more likely that people will steal my books. Now, let me give you a different example where the technology makes more difficult the way in which we now do something, but at the same time provides a different way of doing it. And that's the problem of defamation, of what we refer to as slander and libel. So suppose somebody tells lies about me that hurt my reputation, and he tells them to a large enough public to hurt me. The traditional solution is that I sue him. In order for that to work, I have to know who he is, and he has to have enough money so he's worth suing. Under the old technology, I could do that, because in order to get the message to lots of people, it wasn't really practical to mail out a million anonymous letters. So to get the message to lots of people, you had to put it in a book or a newspaper or a radio program. Then I know who you are. And in order to publish a book, either you or your publisher has money. Similarly for the other things. That doesn't work anymore. Anybody, including any poor student, can get a web page. On that web page, you can put lies about me. If you're reasonably clever, you can do it without anybody knowing who you are. And even if you're not clever, knowing who you are is no good if you have no money. So I can't sue you. So the question is, how do I defend myself against lies? And the answer is that there have always been two ways of defending against lies. And suing people is not the better way. The better way is to answer them. And the same technology that lets a student who wants to lie about me online do so also makes it enormously easier for me to answer him than it used to be. And I will start not with the web, but with a slightly older part of the internet that you may or may not be familiar with, which is called Usenet. And Usenet is a part of the internet that looks like a whole lot of bulletin boards, but is in fact decentralized. I won't go into the details. But tens of thousands of bulletin boards, each a conversation on some topic. Google covers Usenet as well as the web. The result is that I can, in about 2 minutes, find out if anybody today has mentioned my name on Usenet. And I do, I should say, every day. If they have, in another couple of minutes, I can put a message on the same bulletin board that their statement was on that will be read by the same people. It's as if I was sitting on a hill, and any time anyone mentioned my name, the winds of the world blew it to my ears, and I could answer it. To some extent, I can do it on the web, but not as well. Because the problem is that if you slander me on a web page, I can put a response up on my web page, but the people who read it may not see it. There is a technological solution to this problem. The solution is for web browsers to provide what are referred to as backlinks. An ordinary web browser shows the pages that I have linked to. It doesn't show the pages that have linked to me, but it could. Technologically, one could do it. If it did, then when I put up my answer, I link my answer to the web page that slandered me. Anybody who reads that sees the backlink, follows it, and sees my response. There is a problem. The problem is a legal problem, not a technological problem. One of the issues currently debated, or at least it was being debated when I was looking at this, maybe it's been settled by now, is the question of when it is a violation of copyright law for me to put up a web page that is a modified version of your web page. For example, for a backlink browser to put up your web page with backlinks on it, even though you don't want the backlinks there, because you don't want people to know that you lied about me. All right? So that's a case in which if the law decides that a backlink browser is a violation of the copyright of the person whose web page it is, the technological solution to answering slander online won't work. If it decides the other way, it will work. So what I find interesting about that is that what seem like unrelated issues turn out to fit together. And that it's again a case where the right way, in my view, of dealing with a technological problem is itself to use the technology to solve the problem. So the general lesson that I want to make is that when the technology changes what people can do, the question to ask is, how do I achieve whatever my objective is under the new circumstances, given that the ways I used to do it might not work, but other new ways may work? It's another effect of technology, a somewhat subtler one, is that technology changes the facts of the world, that everybody views the world in a very simplified way. That the world is a very complicated place, and we always have very simple pictures. So that, for example, the news tells you what the temperature is in Madrid today. But of course, there is no such thing as the temperature in Madrid. The temperature in the shade here is one thing. The temperature in the sun there is something else. The temperature where the heating system of a building is letting out heat is something else. So we use the approximate picture of there is one temperature because the real picture is too complicated. That's true of a lot of other differences. One of them, which I discuss a bit about in the book, is one of our approximations is that everybody is either a man or a woman. It isn't true. It has never been true. One of the things I've studied for a different seminar and a different book I'm writing is ancient Jewish law. Ancient Jewish law recognized four different sexes. Male, female, hermaphrodite, and something that we're not sure what it was. It was somebody who was either male or female, but there was a reason you couldn't tell. And we aren't sure what was going on with that. All right. Well, but of course, nowadays, there are at least males, females, and hermaphrodites. But we know enough about genetics to know that although almost everybody has either XX or XY chromosomes, there are a few people who have XXY or any of several other variants. So in that sense, everyone is a man or a woman is a very good approximation, but it's not quite right. And there are other complications. There are people who, at least by their own report, are men by their bodies but women in their heads, or women by their bodies and men in their heads. There is, in fact, one fairly prominent economist who got a sex change operation. He is now she. Donald is now Deirdre. That's right. Her story, by the way, is that when she told the chairman of her department that she was going to become a woman, he said, "That's wonderful. we get one more woman and one fewer man, and I don't have to hire or fire anybody. So as we know more, the approximations we use to make sense of the world sometimes break down, and that sometimes is a problem. And one of my, the reason I'm aware of this one is one of my students did a paper on it. I should say, I exploit my students. They exploit me. Mutual exploitation is the reason that we are a social species and not a solitary species. So they learn things from me and I learn things from them. And the students in a seminar like this write papers on things I don't know about and I learn about them. I should say the student's paper was on the question of how different legal institutions deal with this problem. How does sports deal with the question of who is a man and a woman? How do prisons deal with it? How does marriage law deal with it? And so forth. Let me give you a different example, and one which is also has changed. And that is that we have taken it for granted for a long time, with good reason, that every child has a mother and a father. That mother and father are well-defined terms. Mother is not only a well-defined term, we know who it is. They say it's a wise child that knows his father, but most children know who their fathers are. There was a real legal case in California a few years ago involving a child with five parents. The law assumed that there was a mother and father. How did this happen? There was a married couple where the husband was sterile and the wife was doubly infertile. She could neither produce a viable egg nor bring a fetus to term. The market solves this problem. They bought an egg, arranged for a sperm donor, and hired a host mother. They produced a baby. Wonderful, no problem. Except that about the time the baby was born, the couple got divorced. Who had the legal rights and obligations for that baby? All right. The legal answer, if you read the law of California as it then stood literally, the answer was quite clear. The host mother was the mother of the baby, and her husband was the father of the baby. Because there is a legal rule in the common law, called Lord Mansfield's rule, which says that a married man cannot contest the paternity of his wife's children if they were conceived when the couple were cohabiting. The court, I think, very sensibly decided to ignore the law and define parenthood by intention and said the original couple were the legal parents of that. But that's an example of how as the technology changes, law and customs and language and everything else has to adapt. Let me give you a different example of the same sort. We have long taken it for granted that everybody is either dead or alive. It's never been quite perfectly true. It's never been entirely true legally, because there are people who are legally dead and then show up. And it's never been entirely true medically, because there isn't really an exact line between life and death. You have somebody in a coma, his heart has stopped, but there's still activity in the brain or the brain and so forth. But it was so close to true that it didn't matter very much. Well, there are at this point, I think, a couple of hundred people of whom it's not really clear if they're alive or dead. And that's because of what's referred to as cryonics. Cryonics is the idea of freezing people. All right. Let us suppose you are dying of a currently incurable disease, and you are a technological optimist. You are so optimistic that not only do you believe that that disease will eventually be cured, you believe that it will eventually be possible to revive people who've been frozen. Because if you freeze somebody and keep them at the temperature of liquid nitrogen, nothing changes. Well, this is real. Whether it works, well, we don't know yet. All right? The experiment to find out whether it works takes a while. You have to wait a century to see whether you can do it. If you're dying of a lethal disease, you don't feel like waiting 100 years to find out. So there have been something, or I think the number is somewhere around 200 people, who have arranged as soon as they were legally dead, but before, in effect, they were, before enough damage had been done to their brain so that they thought they couldn't be, so that other people thought they couldn't be revived, they weren't thinking anymore, were frozen, lowered to the temperature of liquid nitrogen. The technology has improved over time. You have your choice, by the way, of having the whole body frozen or just the head. The theory of the latter being if the technology is good enough to revive you, it's good enough to regrow your body. And it's easier to freeze the head without damage than to freeze the whole body without damage. It's a smaller object. So you can sign a contract with Alcor, which is the main nonprofit that does this, in which you buy life insurance. The life insurance will pay the cost of freezing you and keeping you frozen. And you try to arrange that if you're dying, their people show up. There is, however, a number of practical problems. One legal problem is that, except now in one state in the U.S., suicide is illegal. Your chance of being revived is considerably better if you're frozen 10 minutes before you die rather than 10 minutes after. That's murder. Or suicide, according to how you arrange it. There was a legal case in California where somebody was dying of brain cancer and he wanted to be frozen real soon now, because otherwise by the time he was frozen, there wouldn't be enough of his brain left to be of any use. And the California court refused. The California court held that that would be murder. Fortunately, I gather the cancer reversed. And so I don't know if he's still alive, but at least he did not die in the near future. But that's an example. But there are other examples. The story I like to tell is, imagine that I get myself frozen and my wife is now a widow under current law, because currently I got to be legally dead before they can freeze you. So she remarries. I'm dead, so people inherit my wealth. And then 10 years later, a news story reports that they have successfully revived a dog. And he barked. And it's pretty clear that in not too long they'll be able to do it for humans. The next day, my wife's new husband and my heir break into Alcor at night and smash the container that holds my body. And when they are asked why they did this, they explain that they could not stand to have someone dear to them kept in such a travesty of life. What crime have they committed? Well, they committed breaking and entry. They're going to have some prison sentence. But there's one crime they can't have committed. Murder, because I'm legally already dead. So that shows how legal systems have to adjust to changes in technology. They've somehow got to define a category in between alive and dead to follow such cases. Let me go on to some other ones, and in particular to one that ought to be of particular interest to libertarians, because it has the potential to make the world much better in the ways we would like. But there are other technologies with the opposite potential. And the technology I'm thinking about first is encryption. How many of you know what public key encryption is? So a few do, but most don't. Encryption is scrambling messages, encoding messages so that other people can't read them. And the problem with ordinary encryption is that if I want to send you a coded message, I have to also send you the code. I have to also send you the key that tells you how to uncode it. But if I don't have a safe way of getting you the message, I may not have a safe way of getting you the key. And if whoever I am afraid is spying on me intercepts the key and copies it, now he can read my secret messages. This problem was solved, I think, about 30 years ago, maybe 40 years by now, by a technology in which you create not one key but two, and one of the keys unscrambles whatever the other key scrambles. So I create a pair of keys. One of them is called my private key, and I never give it to anybody. The other is called my public key, and I give it to everybody. If you want to send me a secret message, you scramble it with my public key, you send it to me, and I unscramble it with my private key. If he has my public key, fine. He can send me secret messages too. But he can't read your message, because what scrambles doesn't unscramble. That means if you have a fully functioning public key infrastructure where everybody is distributed as public key, that you can send a secret message to anybody at all that nobody but he can read. That's an extraordinarily private world. Furthermore, you can send a message to somebody and prove it's from you. Because if you encrypt a message with your private key and then encrypt it with his public key, and have a note attached saying who it's from, he decrypts it with his public key. He then decrypts it with your public key, because each key unscrambles what the other one scrambles. And the fact that he has a message means it must have come from you, because it must have been encrypted with your private key that only you have. That's the essence of how digital signatures work. So that means we have a technology with which anyone in the world can communicate secretly with anybody else, and anybody in the world can prove he is if he wants to. It turns out that there are also ways of using the technology to create what's called anonymous e-cash, anonymous digital money. And if that exists, it becomes possible to pay people in a way in which nobody else can observe, and which doesn't require either that you know the real identity of the person you're paying, you only have to know how to get him a message, or that he knows your real identity, or that the bank knows who either of you is. So that means you could have a world in which people combined anonymity with reputation, in which you exist online with a name that you've invented. Other people can communicate with you because you've published that name's public key. Other people can do business with you, but nobody has to know whether you're a man, a woman, how old, what continent you live on, or anything else. It is very hard to arrest somebody if you don't know who he is. So that means that with a fully developed system of public key encryption, including anonymous e-cash, you could have a world where people did business with each other with complete privacy, with no control at all from the government. And if you think it through, this has desirable and undesirable consequences. Anonymous e-cash makes kidnapping easier because you can't catch people on the payoff, because they can get paid off in e-cash. It also makes enforcing many bad laws much harder, because it means, for example, that if you earn money online and spend it online, the IRS never sees it, which means they can't tax it. And if the world is developing so that more and more of what we're doing is online, the result is that more and more of our world can be entirely private. That's a very attractive feature. One way I like to put it is that it's the ideal libertarian world, because what libertarians are worried about is force and fraud. And online, it's only fraud. You can't get a bullet through a T1 line. All right? So that means that there is the potential for what is sometimes described as crypto anarchy, for a future where much of what's happening is online, all of it is protected by strong encryption, and thus people can do things the government can't control. I could discuss that at more length if I had time, but again, you can read the book if you like. On the other hand, there's another technology which is pushing us in exactly the opposite direction, and that's surveillance. All right? Consider the situation. Already a lot of it exists in England. You have a lot of video cameras on light posts, and these video cameras are watching for crime, perfectly reasonable thing to do. Sounds very much like having a policeman watch for crime. Except that in addition to video cameras, we now have face recognition software and databases. And that means that in a little while, all the information from all the video cameras can be being analyzed by computers, fed into databases, with the result that whoever controls that system knows what everybody was doing at every instant, anywhere in public. So you go from a world with more privacy than we've ever known to a world with less privacy than we've ever known. I like to imagine the trial where the prosecutor, who's a little bit out of date, says to the defendant, "Where were you at 3 p.m. on Monday the 17th of March? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that." There's the video. All right? So, and of course, the cameras don't have to be on light poles. As the technology develops, you are going to have video cameras with the size and behavioral characteristics of mosquitoes. So at that point, everything is a public place. All right. So you could have what one author described as the transparent society. What if you get both technologies? You might have a future which is more private than we've ever known online and less private than we've ever known in real space. And what matters for how that turns out is two things. One of them is how much that we do is online and how much in real space. Because if we have highly developed virtual reality and everybody has high-speed connections, it might turn out that the cameras can watch you all they like online, like in real space. No one is doing anything in real space, including committing crimes and conspiring against the government and saying treasonous things and so on. The other thing that matters is whether you can control your link to cyberspace or whether the video mosquitoes can watch you typing. Because it is no good to encrypt your message if somebody is watching you type it in. So there are various ways you could imagine doing that. So all of this, I'm trying to give you a little feel for how wide the range of possibilities are. Now, I don't have enough time, and it's a long book. So let me run through very briefly some of the other things that I think might happen. I don't predict which ones will happen. One of them is designer babies. The idea of eugenics has a bad reputation because people think of eugenics as some people deciding what children other people will have, breeding for better humans. But there's an idea for eugenics that was created by the science fiction author Robert Heinlein, who some of you have read, some of whose work is very libertarian, not all of it. He's an interesting guy. And he had an idea which was a form of eugenics in which instead of my deciding what children you have, my wife and I decide of the children we could have, which ones do we have? So that after all, I produce millions of sperm, she produces, I suppose, thousands, or I don't know what the number is, but a large number of eggs. If only your technology was good enough, you could pick the egg that does not have her bad circulation, the sperm that does not have my hereditary bad heart, the egg that does have her musical ability, and the sperm that does not have my musical ability, which we won't talk about very much, and so produce the best of our children. That was Heinlein's idea. And in the world where you have that technology, the human race is going to change very rapidly. All right? So that your grandchildren are not going to have a very high opinion of you, except for thanking you for bringing them into existence. Because they're going to be a lot smarter than you are and a lot more beautiful than you are and a lot healthier than you are. And they'll be good at music, too. Let me take a different technology. It may not have occurred to you, but everybody in this room is dying from a disease that is currently incurable. We call it old age. There is no reason why that should keep happening. If you think of the basic logic of human biology, the information that describes your body is genetic information, and you have a very large number of copies. Every cell in your body has that information. You can't lose information with that much redundancy. So in principle, if you only knew enough, we could always rebuild your body young. Biology and medicine have made enormous progress in the last 100 years. It's almost true that 100 years ago, there were no curable diseases. That's only a very slight exaggeration. They could cure the vitamin deficiency diseases like scurvy. But almost all of the diseases, at that point, they could make it easier for you to recover. They could predict so you knew whether to make your will or not, but they couldn't cure it. And starting about 1920, with the sulfa drugs and the antibiotics, doctors could do what they've been pretending to do for thousands of years, cure diseases. So progress has been enormously rapid. I think it is better than even odds that my children will never get old. They might die for other reasons, but they won't get old. It's probably too late for me, unfortunately, though I hope not. But one of the things we're thinking about is if we do cure old age, what will lives be like? If you didn't expect to die of old age, what kind of a life would you live? And I will leave you. I discuss that at some length in the book. Let me go on to some other problems. I gave a talk about my book at Google, at their headquarters, which is pretty near me, back when it was published. And I started out by saying that I thought global warming was a pretty wimpy catastrophe. So global warming raises the temperature of the Earth by a few degrees. It raises sea levels by a foot or so. It takes 100 years to do it. I've got 3 different ways of wiping out the human race faster than that. One of them is one of my favorite technologies, namely nanotechnology. All right? If you think about it, everything humans build is, from the standpoint of atoms, engineered at a very coarse scale. that the microprocessor in my computer, every piece in that involves billions or trillions of atoms. Every living creature, however, is engineered at the atomic scale. If you figure out how biology works, DNA and proteins and all the rest of that system essentially involves molecular machines. And the idea was proposed by a famous physicist quite a while ago and then picked up by a man called Drexler, who's also a libertarian, of what you could do if we learned how to engineer things by putting atoms together so that you could have molecular machines. And it's a very interesting and attractive idea, and it's got some very good, very attractive features. For example, a red blood cell is basically a machine for storing oxygen. That's what carries the oxygen through your bloodstream from your lungs to the rest of you. It's not a very good machine for storing oxygen. And somebody worked out the design of a nanotech equivalent for a red blood cell. Essentially a very tiny compressed air machine that would work just like a red blood cell. And you imagine that you inject yourself with a bunch of these. And it doesn't really matter until the day you have a heart attack. And the day you have a heart attack, you call up the doctor to schedule a treatment. And you've got 4 or 5 hours to do it because that's how much oxygen is in your bloodstream. And you don't need your heart pumping if the oxygen is already there. So that's one example. Now, that's a rather mild example. The really radical one is a cell repair machine. You build a miniature submarine, a robot submarine much smaller than a cell, and it goes through your cells fixing everything that's wrong. This is the general solution. Now, you might say it's going to take a very long time for all your cells, but that's all right. Because the first thing you do when you're developing nanotechnology is you build a molecular machine for building other molecular machines. What's called a general purpose assembler, a little robot factory. And what do you think the first thing you do, you build with your general purpose assembler is? Another general purpose assembler. And what do you do with your first 2 general purpose assemblers? You make 4 general purpose assemblers. All right? So that once you've got 1 general purpose assembler, all you have to do is to feed it atoms. We've got lots of atoms. This is a world where the raw material is a bunch of identical things readily available. You just plug them together. So once you have 1 general purpose assembler, you have as many as you want. And once we have 10 million of them, we can make 10 million cell repair machines and turn them loose. So it's a very powerful technology. Unfortunately, it's got some risks. Because suppose instead of making this very complicated general purpose assembler, which can reproduce itself and make many other things, you make a very, very simple machine that can reproduce itself, that uses commonly available atoms and sunlight or some other easily available source of energy to make copies of itself. And you carelessly let it go. And it starts turning everything it meets into copies of itself, each of which turns everything it meets into copies of itself. And in a week or so, the entire world is copies of that one little thing, little replicator. This is what's referred to in nanotech circles as the gray goo scenario. The idea of a very efficient replicator turning the entire world into gray goo. Nanotech is a very powerful technology. It's so powerful that even libertarians worry about it. Drexler and his friends, for example. And there have been various proposals to in some way have a government control over nanotech to make sure that some really bright high school kid doesn't end the world in his basement by creating a replicator. The problem with this is that that's one version of destructive nanotech. You can think of other versions of destructive nanotech. You could think of the equivalent of a tailored disease designed to kill bad guys, however you define bad guys. All right? It could be designed to kill only communists or only libertarians or only black people or only white people. And it might mutate and start killing more people than it was supposed to. So you can think of a number of ways of ending the world with nanotech. Who is most likely to build such a machine? All right. Who currently spend lots and lots of money building machines to kill people? It's not private governments, right? Military governments. So you can imagine 2 stages in the development of nanotech. The first stage is where nanotech is really hard, where it's rocket science, so to speak. In that stage, no high school kid in his basement can end the world. But the U.S. Defense Department might be able to do it. So if the government controls nanotech, which is the usual proposal, that means that you won't have companies making defensive nanotech, which human beings would like, but you might still have governments making offensive nanotech. The next is the world where nanotech gets easy. In that case, the only hope for saving the world is to have people making the defensive equivalent, just as your body has defenses. After all, we suffer nanotech attacks all the time. We call them diseases. Fortunately, we have nanotech defenses built into us by evolution. So I think the best hope of avoiding the nanotech plague is to have lots of nanotech, because very little money will be spent privately on creating destructive nanotech, but a whole lot will be spent privately on creating defensive. If it turns out that attack is much easier than offense, we're in trouble. But so far, for the kind of nanotech that now exists, namely living creatures, it isn't true. Large objects like us and whales still exist, even though there are small objects like viruses, which are replicators, and so forth. All right. I'm going for too long, so let me give you very briefly a few of the other technologies. Another one of them is artificial intelligence. One of the old puzzles is what we are. What is a human being? And the best guess I have is that I am software, that I am a computer program running on the computer of my mind. I'm not sure it's right. Maybe I've got a immaterial soul. I don't know. But computer programs come closer to acting like humans than anything else does. If that's right, computers are getting better and better. And in a while, we'll be able to make computers as smart as we are. And if those computers are people, that'll be very interesting. We'll have a kind of people very different from us. And that raises a lot of issues if some of the people are software. But the real problem is that if the computers keep getting faster and we don't, 10 years after we have human-level computers, we are pets. Because we have computers as much smarter as we are as we're smarter than gerbils. And we'd better hope they like pets. That's one of my ways of ending the world, along with nanotech plagues. I should say Raymond Kurzweil, who's a computer pioneer who's thought a lot about this, has a solution. His solution is we become computers too. His solution is that when we know enough to make AI, we know enough about how the mind works so that we can start doing more and more of our thinking in silicon. So your mind has a mind-to-machine link. You have a computer that you carry around with you all the time. Actually, I do have two of them, but not quite good enough for the purpose yet. And as the computers get smarter, you get smarter because you're doing the part of your thinking that's in silicon faster and faster. And eventually, your body and your brain, you keep around for sentimental reasons, but really most of you is in a computer. That's Kurzweil's solution. Virtual reality is another one. The current versions of virtual reality are things like the telephone, where you talk to somebody although you're not there. It's sort of weird. It used to be if you saw someone walking down the street talking to the air, you thought he was crazy. Now you know he's on a cell phone. You have the potential for really good VR, which you get when you figure out how dreaming works. Because dreaming is a form of virtual reality every night. And it's full sense virtual reality. You can hear things. Maybe you can even smell things. So when we have really good VR, now when you are connected to the computer, it can give you a full sense illusion, all right, of feeling, touching, smelling, everything. And you can then imagine the world that gives you. And looked at in real space, it's a very poor world. Because everybody's living in a little tiny cubicle, and everybody's eating soybean paste, or whatever the cheapest form of nutrition is. But that's all right. Because to you, that soybean paste is sushi and Baskin-Robbins ice cream and filet mignon, whatever you like, because that's sensation, not physical stuff. All right? And so one of the things we're thinking about is that world heaven or hell? Because from one standpoint, you would say, it's hell, you're all living very poorly. From another, it's heaven. Everybody has a mansion on the Pacific coast. Everybody eats the most luxurious foods and never gets fat. Would I like that? Yes. And so forth. So that's another one to think about. One last technology, because I've talked longer than I planned, but and that technology is what I think of as mind drugs. Mind drugs are drugs that affect the mind. And they already exist. And there are really three, loosely speaking, three kinds of mind drugs, or three ways mind drugs are used. One of them is that you use mind drugs to modify yourself, to stay awake, for example. Coffee is a mind drug. One of them is you use mind drugs to control other people. There is this old phrase in English, candy is dandy, but liquor is quicker. That is that one way of seducing a woman is to get her drunk. You use mind drugs to give you pleasure because you enjoy the effect. All right. Alcohol, in fact, is all three mind drugs. People drink alcohol because it makes them feel good. They use alcohol to try to control other people. And they use alcohol because somebody who is relaxed may feel he actually performs better. We are learning more and more about mind and the drugs. And it is worth thinking about what might be the effect if we had mind drugs that worked very well. Suppose, for example, we have a credulity drug that makes people believe things. That's not a very attractive idea. We're almost certainly going to have drugs that make people smarter. We may already have drugs that make people smarter. Some people think we do. There are arguments about that. There's, as you may know, there's a drug that's prescribed for children who are supposed to have what's called ADD, attention deficit disorder. You can't tell whether somebody has ADD by giving him that drug, because it's true that the drug makes it easier for people with ADD to concentrate, but it makes it easier for everybody else to concentrate too. So from one standpoint, that drug is a mind drug, which for some purposes is quite useful. So you may want to think about what the world is going to be like if we have drugs that are both very good at making you better at doing things, drugs such that you no longer have to sleep. We've got one that does a good deal of that already called Motivinyl, and drugs that some people can use to control other people. But of course, we may have many technologies so that the control against the credulity drug may be the little nanotech device that's built into your left wrist, which flashes red whenever it detects such a drug in your bloodstream. And you know, don't believe whatever he says. My final question is, can technology make the world worse? And a lot of people have predicted it in the past and they've been wrong. That so far, in fact, the world has gotten generally better through the last few hundred years, at least. You might argue that technology has to be good because it increases what we can do, and being able to do things is good. But there are a couple of problems. One is it increases what other people can do, including what they can do to us. And there's also a more general problem. All societies face a problem that economists refer to as the coordination problem. How, with millions of people, do you get them to cooperate? So that if I want to bake a pencil, someone is cutting down a tree, someone is making the chainsaw to cut down the tree, someone is making the steel to make the chainsaw, and so forth. And there are two solutions to that problem, and one of them doesn't work. The obvious solution that doesn't work is centralized coordination. Someone gives orders to everybody. And that works for very small groups of people, but breaks down for large groups. That's why the Soviet Union collapsed, basically. The solution that does work is a decentralized system where somehow we divide up the problem so each person solves a little tiny bit of it and solves it right. And that's what private property and markets and exchange do. But in order for that to work, we have to have a way of dividing up the world such that what I do mostly has effects on my part of the world and what you do mostly has effects on your part of the world. The more powerful we are, the harder it might be to do that. Because the more powerful we are, the longer the range of our effects. So there is a possibility that as we become able to do more and more, we might be reduced from one solution to zero solutions. All right. Let me go back with the last few words on global warming. As it happens, I don't think global warming is a serious problem. That's a different talk. You can find it on my webpage if you're curious. But it could be a serious problem. All right. Suppose global warming was going to increase the temperature of the Earth by 40 degrees instead of by 3 degrees and raise sea level by 100 feet instead of 1 foot. It's still not clear we could stop it because each individual person correctly believes that the carbon dioxide he puts out has a tiny effect. So he has no incentive to worry about it. Even each country believes that the amount it puts out has a small effect because most of the effects are in other countries. So it might turn out that if global warming was a terrible problem, that the only solution was the solution that doesn't work, namely centralized coordination, then you would have to have a world government. And a world government is a cure worse than the disease. Well, not than the disease of killing everybody, but than any likely disease. Right? So my final point is that technological change can make things very much better. My guess is it will. It could make things very much worse. It could make the world very much freer through things like encryption. Could make it much less free if mind drugs mean that we're all enslaved to whoever first spikes our drink with the drug that makes us obey them. So it's going to be a very interesting century. And for more details, read the book. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bueno, tras esta interesante charla, pues vamos a abrir un turno de preguntas para que todos aquellos que queráis, y seguro, estoy seguro que habrá muchas cuestiones, pues podáis, dentro del tiempo, que no va a ser eterno, pues plantear vuestras dudas al profesor Friedman. Como ya os ha comentado antes Luigi, si no os sentís cómodos planteando las preguntas en inglés, se las podéis plantear a él en castellano, las traducirá y podréis atender a la respuesta de Friedman. Vale, tenemos media hora, ¿de acuerdo? Pues bueno, ¿quién quiere empezar? Pablo.
Will we see a free society in how long?
The lifespan.
Your lifetime or mine? the answer is we might see a much freer society. I am not a utopian. I doubt you ever get perfect results. I think there are a number of ways you might get a freer society, some of them depending on technology. As you may know, my son Patri has one idea, which is a technology for floating housing on the ocean, where people create their own communities at sea and reorganize them as they like, and that could give you a free society. As I've suggested in this talk, you could have a free society online in a world where almost everything that mattered was online. So that's, I think, one possible route. You could have a much freer society because the kind of ideas that we try to spread. That it seems unlikely. And yet, as you may know, when Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations in 1776, one of the things he wrote was that it was less likely that England would ever abandon its restraints on free trade than that utopia would be created. About 70 years later, England abandoned its restraints on free trade, partly due to Adam Smith's book. So things can change, and you know, we don't have very good theories of why societies do what they do. Another possibility, which is related to the one to the cyberspace one, but a little bit different, is if enough of what we do is done online, taxpayers become much more mobile. If most of your friends are friends who you can be friends with wherever you are because you connect to them through the internet. If your job is one which you can do from anywhere in the world because you're doing it online. In that world, governments have much more need to compete for taxpayers than they do now. And the more governments have to compete, the more they are constrained to treat people well. So you might get real space-free societies, not because everybody has vanished to cyberspace, but because cyberspace has made people much more mobile. So sort of part of the lesson that I want people to get from my book and the talk is that the future really is radically uncertain, that one can tell plausible stories in which the world gets better, but much better for us. There are some ways in which you can predict it's getting much better. It's pretty clear that medicine is going to keep improving. My guess is that in 20 or maybe 30 years, almost all cancers will be curable because we're beginning to discover how cancer works. So what we now do is really a very brute force approach, which sometimes works, but which is sort of cutting things out. It's not like the way you cure a disease by giving people medicine. We're learning gradually to do that. But I think that political outcomes are very uncertain. And in general, sort of the big broad outcomes are very uncertain, because you can imagine technologies that make governments stronger and technologies that make governments weaker, and both of those could happen. If you think about computers, early on, I think a lot of people thought computers would make governments stronger. The idea was socialism can finally work because a computer can solve the problem. It turns out it isn't true. Probably, maybe it will never be true. The problem is much, much harder than it looked. All right. On the other hand, computers got so cheap that everybody had them. And the one result, I think, is the increased spread of libertarianism. Because it's really hard to defend a political view when everybody you know thinks you're crazy. But nowadays, everybody you know isn't limited to a radius of a couple of miles. So now, unpopular views, people can interact with people who share them, they can discuss them, they can encourage each other, they can reinforce it in a way in which it couldn't be done 50 years ago. So in fact, in many ways, computers have actually made governments weaker and strengthened things. So it's very hard. As somebody once said, prediction is very hard, especially about the future.
You have talked about the anonymous cash, yes. Electronic cash. Well, I know you're aware of Bitcoin, no? As Professor
yes.
has explained.
Yes.
And you were talking about the anonymous, okay? Bitcoin is anonymous, but and about kidnapping and not
yes.
having the...
Yes.
Are you aware that Bitcoin is completely traceable? You know, all transactions in Bitcoin are full, like...
But traceable to what? Can you add
to the payment? So the family who pays the criminal.
The person or the internet connection?
No, okay. The transaction.
Yeah.
To pay the family knows what the transaction is.
But they do not know who received the money.
Yeah, but you can trace the money, so you can repudiate that money. So you can.
But if you can repudiate the money,
yeah.
then why can't I buy something
no,
from
I
you?
Mean, I mean, okay, you made the transaction and you lose them, and the family lose the money.
Yes.
The money.
Right,
but the criminal cannot spend that money because nobody will accept that money because it's ransom money. You understand?
The real answer is I do not understand the technology well enough to know whether you're right. It may be that you are right, but
I know.
Yes, you would be amazed at the number of people who know they are right. But the ultimate question is whether it can both do the work of an anonymous digital cash and have the virtues you describe. But we could talk about it maybe later, or by email or something.
Well, the people who say that Bitcoin is not re-anonymous, well, okay, you must have an identity.
And does that identity have to be one that can be arrested?
No.
In that case, the kidnapper can have it.
Well, they can trace your IP and... Well, but that's a different problem, okay?
Yes.
But even if you... Well, there are solutions for that. Like
there sure are. That's right.
But you can always trace them all. So you can... Some people won't accept that ransom.
Maybe.
And you're
going to
still make it anonymous.
We
can. Sure. First of all, Professor Freeman, thank you for being here with us tonight. Many of the things you said in this conference were controversial, provocative, especially for people like me, come from a pretty conservative background. So my question is, do you as a libertarian believe in natural law?
It's a good question. The answer is, I do not believe in trying to use natural law to persuade people to libertarian views. And I don't believe in that because I don't have sufficiently good arguments to defend or to derive my moral beliefs. That there is a sense in which I believe in natural law, that as I believe certain things are right and certain things are wrong, and I believe that that's relevant to the choices one makes. But I don't think that I or anybody else, as far as I can tell, really has an adequate theory of moral philosophy, which will let them say to someone who doesn't believe that certain things are wrong, here I can prove they are. As you may know, the philosopher David Hume argued that there is an unbridgeable gap between is and ought, that there is no way that from a set of is statements you can derive an ought statement without putting in an ought statement to start with. And I think he's correct. And if he is correct, it doesn't make a lot of sense for me to say to somebody, you should believe in liberty because coercing people is wrong. Because if he doesn't believe coercing people is wrong, I can't show him that coercing people is wrong. But it does make sense for me to say, you should believe in liberty because liberty will create a world you will like more. And since my opinion, though I might be wrong, is that free societies are not only better than unfree societies, they're a lot better. The result is there will be very few human beings who would prefer what I think are the actual results of unfree rules to what I think are the actual results of free world rules. The way I like to put it is that I do not think I have ever met a socialist who would be in favor of the society that I believe socialism would create. So that means my disagreement with the socialist is fundamentally not a disagreement about what we want, though we might have that too. It's fundamentally a disagreement about what the results of socialism or laissez-faire would be. I think economics is a much better developed science than moral philosophy, that moral philosophers have been working on the project for a couple of thousand years, and they still read Plato. We don't still read Aristotle on economics or on physics. That's another developed science. So I guess my view is that I believe in it in the sense of thinking that some things are right or wrong. Now, I should also say that I think natural law or morals in general is more complicated than people think. That I spend a chapter in my book, Machinery of Freedom, taking natural law as libertarians like to describe it and showing how it leads to conclusions that nobody believes in. And I'm arguing that, therefore, an accurate description would have to be more complicated than people want to think. So that's a further issue.
¿Más preguntas?
What do you think about e-programming, this project that tried to improve democracies by using internet to allow people voting on government policies?
Yeah. The problem with that solution is that it doesn't solve the real problem. The real problem here is what economists who study politics refer to as rational ignorance. And that is that in order to know what policy is right or what politician to vote for, it doesn't matter really whether you're voting on policy or politicians, you need quite a lot of information. For the individual policy, the defenders of each side will argue it's right. For the individual politician, politicians always claim to be the good guy. For some reason, they never run as the bad guy. And there is no incentive for the ordinary voter to get that information, because if you have, except in a very small group, democracy can work for very small groups. But I live in a country of 300 million people. The chance that my vote will change the outcome of the presidential election is maybe 1 in 5 million. You're in a smaller country. Maybe your odds are 1 in a million. If you're voting in for something smaller, a little higher. But they're very, very low. And so it does not pay to buy information when it's worth much less than it costs. And the result is that voters are rationally ignorant, and they'll still be rationally ignorant in your system. So, or not your system, but in the system, in the system you're describing. I don't know if it works better or worse than what we have. That's a separate issue. But I don't think there's any way of democracy, making democracy work well, except for very, very small groups.
And I'd like to hear your thoughts about nuclear technology, especially why aren't we there yet? Why aren't, I mean...
About what technology?
Nuclear technology.
Yes.
Why aren't we there yet? I mean, you said that nanotechnology, a kid in a basement, could kill us all. Yeah. So what about nuclear technology? In 70 years, that nothing went wrong. So...
I'm not sure I understand you. Are you saying in 70 years will people be able to blow up the world in their basement too?
No, in the last 70 years of nuclear technology, we haven't been killed by some kids in their basement.
So. That's true, but in the last 70 years, it has not been possible for a kid in his basement to make an atomic bomb, because making an atomic bomb requires uranium or plutonium or various other rare things. And first, the kid in the basement would die in the process from radiation poisoning. And beyond that, those are very expensive materials. And finally, an atomic bomb can't end the world. can't even come close to ending the world. It's not even clear if the U.S. and the Soviet Union would have ended the world if they had a thermonuclear war. They would have killed pretty clearly hundreds of millions of people. But there are more people than that. All right? But so we haven't had a technology yet where without a lot of resources, you could kill a lot of people. Right? I suppose 9/11 is about the record. And that required somebody, a very clever, simple plan in which you were stealing the resources you needed, namely the airplanes. And that killed a few thousand people. You know, we kill that many more than that every year on the highways. So by world catastrophes, it was a lot bad for those people, but it was still a fairly small event. So we haven't had that situation. We had a situation where governments might have been able to end the world and at least kill a lot of people. And that didn't happen, but that's a lot. There are only a very small number of governments, only really two that could do it. And so they didn't, fortunately.
I have a question. It's about the internet.
Yes.
With so many regulations right now, so far with all these self-regulations and red tape around the internet, do you foresee that maybe in the near future, capital can develop a redundant internet, free of control and red tape, and running out of profit, and maybe we can develop a free society in that?
So you want a second internet, you're saying?
Yeah, but not maybe an internet reliant on satellites and cable, but something else like maybe that we don't know now.
Maybe, but I think that's certainly possible. And I think more likely it is that it will simply prove to be very difficult to control the internet, which is what's happened so far. SOPA didn't pass, of course. And at least in the U.S., opposition to internet controls is pretty well organized because it's organized through the internet by people who are doing it. But in general, it's pretty hard to control because of things like encryption and things like remailers and so forth. So I'm not sure. You know, a government that took it sufficiently seriously could probably effectively regulate the internet, but it would be hard enough. And the internet exists with many different countries, and they have do different things. So my guess is the internet is going to remain pretty free, but we will see.
I guess that, as of today, there are certain apps, cables, going through the sea. That if you shut down those big hubs, you basically shut down the internet.
Of course, but if you shut down the internet, an awful lot of people are going to be very mad at you, including not only a lot of voters, but a lot of government officials and all of their wives and children. And that is part of the point, is that at this point, not that we couldn't live without the internet. We could. We did for a long time. But the internet, it seems to me, is valuable enough to enough people that I think it would be very hard to organize the actual shutting down of it. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's at least my guess.
Bueno, tenemos que terminar aquí. Yo lo lamento porque la verdad es que estaba todo muy interesante, pero se nos ha acabado el tiempo. Muchas gracias a todos por asistir. And thank you very much, Professor Friedman, for coming.
El centro de Ibero nos ha pedido que continuemos la discusión en la calle.